Good afternoon. I want to first just thank Catherine and the panelists from earlier for a wonderful discussion about Line and its extension. It's been pure pleasure working together on this subject and also living with the exhibition Online Drawing Through the 20th Century for these past few months. It has, in some sense, come alive for me, most recently through the dance and performance-based works of Tricia Brown and the performed actions of Marie Kuhl and Fabio Balducci, whose work you see behind me here, and I'm just going to let it kind of run as I speak, and whose work I'd like to invoke to introduce our topic of discussion this afternoon, the performative line, which I think will be equally discursive as the earlier panel. From early on organizing Online, it was our intention to extend the notion of movement, which is so present throughout the exhibition, into actual movement in space. Were there, we wondered, works of dance and or movement-based performance that in some ways engaged with the idea or form of line? For my own thinking, this has led into a territory which I think Nick Kay on our panel may address with his notion of liveness, or forms of movement which exist in something we might call approaching pure action. This is not to say action without content, but uninflected or unencumbered by intention. When I recently saw Ralph Lemon's performance at BAM, in which at one moment a body is pummeled with a fire hose until exhaustion and collapse, and my memory of the performance is that in one's visual memory at that moment in the performance, after going through a sequence of images, is an image of a civil rights protester. So these two things sort of collapsed in the mind of the viewer. I was reminded of, first, our earlier discussion just a moment ago of the ethics of movement, and Ralph's ambition of his project began in 1997, which was the fundamental questioning and reimagining of the relationship between artist, stage, and audience. This occurs for him as an ongoing principle in his work, what he calls his research events, through an active embrace of discomfort, unease, and pushing the emotional and physical boundaries of what the body can do. One might say, and this was my enlightened justification for including his work in our program, I was so struck by it, that the line runs through the bodies of his dancers like an electric shock. His own disjunctive narrative in his performances making a kind of line of social content inscribed somewhere near or parallel to the dance. For those of you who did not happen to see Marie Kuhl, whose work I hope is going to still be going on behind me, we're showing two different works, the work with the steel ball and with the string as well. For those of you who didn't see her performing in the museum's atrium these past few days and this morning, I'm showing you the video which stands in for her practice. And this is important and functions differently than documentation does usually with dance, in that the work itself takes place as it's performed. It takes place the same way publicly as it does privately in the studio. And in fact, the artists went through a time when they only made the work in the studio. There was no public viewership or audience at all. They say, and I believe that the work exists somewhere between drawing, painting, and performance, conceived by Kuhl and her partner, and executed all day long by Kuhl, as you see here. They began making their work in 1995, as I said, turning away from the notion of audience and participation in favor of something hybrid and private. The sources for the work range from the blank affect of the Italian primitive painters, such as Fra Angelico, to the turning of this away of the subject from the viewer in the 18th century and this idea of extreme absorption, to the simple notion of a wave of the ocean in one of the other actions. When I experience this work, I'm reminded of Norman Bryson's discussion of still life painting and the removal of human presence and what he calls the imposition of its values on the world. Far from dissipating in the museum's cavernous atrium space, the force of Kuhl's presence is both riveting and full of controlled power and energy, and yet strangely still. She is there and not there. Her inward gaze is both unnerving when encountered for a long period, and it's the same gaze, I think, as that of Tricia Brown, Yvonne Rainer, Bruce Nauman, and other artists working in the 1960s on, among other things, removing or neutralizing the authorship imposed by their bodies on the otherwise generic movements and studio explorations. And I was thinking about, in the earlier discussion, Luis, this idea of the point and that first connection with the real, which is, of course, Kandinsky's point as well, but thinking about whether there was some parallel, or if this is too rough a kind of parallel between the point made on material or paper and actually that initial mark made by a dancer's or a mover's body in space, whether those two things can be thought of as initial moments of contact. Janet Cranach will speak about Naumann and what she has called a productive redundancy or stutter in his work, a conflation of movement, drawing, and text that occurs in his Beckett Walk and works of the late 1960s, which were deeply informed by dance. So our topic today, the performative line, or as I was telling Ralph, the sort of topic, non-topic, that I've continued to try to bring some form to, is about movement and drawing. Political and social movement, abstract movement, found movement, as well as movement organized as dance. Throughout the century, there is, of course, a narrative of drawing and dance that moves from one of mimesis and direct observation, with artists such as Kandinsky tracing the movements of Gret Palucka, a dancer who performed at the Bauhaus, to the late 1950s and early 1960s, when classical movements break down in the work of Merce Cunningham and Judson in New York, Ligia Clark in Brazil, whose Caminando becomes a kind of performed line, to the Fluxus artists such as Stanley Brown, who I believe Benjamin is going to touch on today, whose line becomes one of many found and ephemeral materials, to the present, where line moves both into the realm of communication, as Catherine referred to earlier, and also to this notion represented for me by the work of Kuhl and Balducci of a kind of extreme analog, which is in some way in reaction, I think, to the internet and to the social space of the web. These are things I hope we can touch on today. And with that, I will welcome our first panelist, which is Janet Cranach. And we're going to change the order just slightly, and Benjamin Buchlo will go last, preceded by Ralph Lemon. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Nick Kay is first. Sorry. Nick, Janet, Ralph, and then Benjamin. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Connie and Catherine for the opportunity to take part in today. In this paper, I'll briefly explore how placing the line in time in performance and in mediation reflects upon experiences of duration and liveness. Where, as Connie points out in her essay Walk Around Time, published in the catalogue to this exhibition, the liberation of the line from the image and picture plane, reflected in work by artists such as Eva Hess, brings real space into the perimeters of the work, so this line stepping beyond the frame also prompts new engagements with time. Thus, commenting on the historical emergence of installation art in his essay The Present Tense of Space in 1978, the artist Robert Morris states flatly that real space cannot be experienced except in real time. Here, where in relation to painting, the line in Hess's work disrupts and yet remains in dialogue with the containment of the picture plane to describe different orders of space, so in the emergent time-based art of the early 1960s, the line and the act of drawing is deployed as score for and prompt to time structures that further delimit the work. It is in this context that the line also becomes an integral part of early intermedial and electronic arts engagement with the limits of the medium and the containment of the object, as this practice turned outward toward the potential of the line to imply performance. Oops. Lamont Young's invitation through Composition No. 10, 1960, dedicated to Robert Morris, to draw a straight line and follow it, describes the underlying position and paradigm of Young's work, and in doing so, focuses on the potential complexity of the line in time. Reflecting an attention to extended continuities, as early as 1958 in Trio for Strings, whose opening C-sharp extends for 4.5 minutes, on Composition No. 7, 1960, which designated F and B-sharp to be held for a long time. In 1964, Young entered into an extended enactment of the line in The Tortoise, His Dreams and Journeys, an open-ended work intended to unfold in a discipline of performance occurring potentially for Young each day throughout his lifetime. Such realizations of the straight line imply extended duration, focus, or discipline, but also, over time, indeterminacy realized in performance, reception, and experience. In these works, Young proposes, tuning is a function of time, meaning that an extended time provides for the definition and synthesis of the elements of the work, such that in listening or performing, the auditor might inhabit the time of the sound itself. Here, the performance of the straight line offers the potential for infinite variation, one which in experience returns to John Cage's conception of the indeterminate work as one that returns to make itself. It becomes a current, a flux. Where Lamont Young's work drew on John Cage's compositional practice, including the graphic indeterminate scores that Cage and other composers such as Earl Brown and Christian Wolff developed in the 1950s, in which the meaning of the line was to be determined by the performer, Namjoon Paik's contemporaneous play with the electronic line was also rooted in a critique of Cage's daily practice of Zen Buddhism. Applying techniques and processes and even the materials of electronic and experimental music to experimental TV in Germany from 1963 and subsequently video art in New York from 1965, Paik's earliest practices articulated close links between his experimental television and live events or activities, in whose combination he frequently articulated one measure or passage of time in the context of another. Characteristic of Paik's early televisual analogues to Cage's prepared pianos, Zen for TV, 1963, offered a television whose hardware had been manipulated, and in this case, whose picture has been destroyed in its transportation, thus reducing its image to a horizontal line. Zen for TV, along with Zen for Film, 1964, explicitly marked Paik's engagement with the absolute emptiness in which Cage, and implicitly Young, reflected on the disciplines of Zen. We have video one, please. With regard to time, Zen for Film is an analogue of the straight line in time. Zen for Film is a blank leader tape which in viewing gradually gives visible testament to its own physical degradation in the real conditions of its projection. The film is an overt response to Cage's 4 minutes 33 of 1952, his first silent composition intended to demonstrate that there is no such thing as an empty space or an empty time. Zen for Film, as Cage proposed, might thus demonstrate that there is never nothing to see. Yet where Cage related Paik's empty projection to the Zen axiom that the mind is like a mirror, it collects dust, the problem is to remove the dust, over time, Zen for Film effects a deliberate erosion of the mirror's transparency that cannot be recovered. Degraded in its projection over time, the blank leader tape is gradually corrupted. As a result, Zen for Film points to a plurality of times, playing across the present tense contemplation invited by the Zen mirror, the accumulating traces inscribed by its past and present projection, as well as its future erasure in the mechanics of the film medium itself. In this regard, Zen for Film poses the question of what it means to be at the threshold of the medium, a threshold defined not simply around the spatial limits of the screen. Indeed, Zen for Film specifically attends to the time structures that mark the limit of the work and its medium, effecting its own gradual destruction in exchanges between the film and its environment. End of video one, please. In its early projection, such concerns were further articulated through Paik's performed interventions into its screening, where at the New Cinema Festival 1, New York, of November 1964, for example, he placed himself in the light of the projection, throwing his shadow on the screen in an amplification of the film's operation across several spaces and times. In Paik's video installations, the line recurs directly as a prompt to the multiple measures of the time of the work. Thus, in TV Clock, 1963, the first of his series of clock pieces, Paik presented the monitor's marking of its own times, revealing in this process distinct yet interdependent measures of the viewer's engagement. TV clock comprises 24 manipulated black and white televisions, in which, after Zen for TV, each screen has been reduced to a single still line of light that, in the sequence of monitors, marks the passage of 12 hours. Explicitly measuring its times, TV clock juxtaposes narratives of clock time and daytime with the viewer's choice and negotiation of their own time within the installation room. Simultaneously, the placement of 24 TV screens operating in a single installation serves to amplify what the video artist Bill Viola describes as the vibrational acoustic of video, and that, he suggests, marks the real-time operation of the machine, an operation which is other to, yet may be mapped by, these allusions to the hours and days of the installation. Video two, please. In performance and dance, too, the drawing of the line acts as a means of displacing attention from one measure of time and from one space to another. Tricia Brown's performance in 2003 of It's a Draw, here from a film by Hugo Glendinning, sustains this complicating of the relationship between the presence of the body, the act of drawing, and concomitantly, the present act and its continual deferral to the line as trace and prompt to activity. Brown's performances, which emerged as part of Judson Church in New York in the early 60s, invariably displace attention from the body and the act towards sight, structure, and process. Here, the line decenters attention, multiplying the terms of the performed work, expanding its parameters, challenging its thresholds and relationship to the real context in which it takes place. In her earlier Man Walking Down the Side of a Building of 1969, the line formed an axis through which the dizzying illusion at once amplified and displaced attention from the presence of the body. It's a Draw complicates the time of performance. It unfolds as the trace of action, as a task dedicated to the pictorial field in which it will be recalled, where the line also acts as a prompt and shaping of the next choreographic phrase. In these regards, It's a Draw acts before and after itself, in anticipation of its own marks, its own traces. End of video two, please. One could end on the line and time in relation to John Cage, whose influence threads its way through these artists' early work. Cage proposes that time is inevitably beyond measure. It can't ever be clock time. Another way of saying it is to affirm that writing is one thing, performing another, and listening a third, and that there is no reason for these three operations to be linked. If I write by imposing a particular measurement of time, the listener will not be confronted with time itself, but the way the performer understands what he has read, and the performer will not have read time, but one measurement of time. It is this articulation of time and times as different and multiple that in these works the line in time reveals, and in which it is performed. Thank you.
Thank you. I ran into Connie a while ago when she and Catherine were first planning the exhibition, and she told me about it, and obviously I was very interested in what they were working on. But given my own preoccupations, the question that popped out of my head was, are you including Naumann's Beckett Walk? And I don't remember Connie's exact response, but something like, well, yes, Naumann's there, very important, where he's going to go, not sure. And we subsequently had some further discussions. But what I later realized was when I asked my initial question, we were actually talking about two different works. I was talking about Beckett Walk. Connie was talking about Beckett Walk. Now, our miscommunication is understandable, as both are Beckett Walks, although they actually have slightly different titles, which I'm going to get into, and both were made by Naumann in the late 1960s. But what the scenario kind of opens up is a larger question, which is, what is the relationship? What is the relationship between these two works? Or if I extrapolate further, what is the relationship of drawing to artwork? And what we typically would say, drawing to final artwork. Now, in the history of art, this seems to be a rather mundane question because an artist will make a preparatory sketch work out his or her ideas, put it to the side, and execute the final work. So even though this is an unconventional medium of video, it begs the question of why would it be any different? But my remarks today are going to be about these very differences. And I want to utilize Naumann's one, or I should say two, works as a case study regarding the fate of drawing in the 1960s. And it's a fate that I want to say is preliminarily, or propose, I should say, preliminarily tied to the creation of an interdisciplinary form of working during the period, which is extremely important, not just to Naumann, but I'm kind of just using him as one place to begin. So I'm going to start actually with a quote from Naumann. I knew this guy in California, an anthropologist, who had a hearing problem in one ear, and so his balance was off. Once he helped one of his sons put a roof on his house, but the son got upset because his shingles would be lined up properly, while his father's were not only laid out in a zigzag, but also the nails were bent and the shingles split. When his son got upset about the mess his father had made, the anthropologist replied, "Well, it's just evidence of a human activity." And that's what Beckett's stories partly deal with. For example, Molloy transferring stones from pocket to pocket. They're all human activities, no matter how limited, strange, and pointless. They're worthy of consideration. End quote. In 1968, during a brief year-long sojourn in the borrowed Southampton studio of Paul Waldman and Roy Lichtenstein, Naumann made Slow Angle Walk, Beckett Walk. And if you could cue the video, please. The video depicts the artist, casually dressed, in a white t-shirt and black jeans, with hands clasped behind his back, performing a series of leg swings. Kicking his leg up in front of his body, he then falls forward while lifting his back leg straight behind, the impact of his foot hitting the floor, creating a discernible thud. The newly suspended leg then swooshes past his partner, swinging forward while raising his torso and rotating. The same series of turns and falls are then repeated over and over. Beckett Walk is one of a series of performance recordings on film and video that Naumann made in the late 60s, in which he enacts limited, strange, and pointless activities over and over in the isolation of his studio. And you can stop the video, please. The nature of Naumann's bodily presentation, however, moves beyond the literary tics of Molloy. Specifically, it incorporates the task dance aesthetic that was the hallmark of the Judson Dance Theater. Founded in 1962 by a group of young dancers, including Yvonne Rainer, Simone Forti, Steve Paxton, amongst others, the Judson Dance Theater was committed to rethinking all aspects of dance, including a radical reconception of what fundamentally is considered movement, or in their case, properly dance movement. The consciously mechanistic implications of the word task dance referred to the use of quote-unquote normal activities, such as running, walking, climbing, and so on, in place of expressive dance gesture. The body was staged as a series of parts, a foot that shifts, a hand that twitches, and a head that nods. This fragmentation of the body and its movements, as opposed to the traditional fluidity and narrative coherence of ballet and modern dance, yielded an unconventional bodily presentation of studied normalcy and even awkwardness, but as Rainer herself emphasized, with an intensity of physical exertion. So her argument was, is despite the fact that it might be a normal movement, it actually required a certain degree of physical energy that was visible to the audience. Now, similarities to Naumann's bodily carriage in his performance recordings are striking. Its neutrality, a refusal to gaze out, the restrictions on movement, the repetition of same or like movements, the use of ordinary gestures such as walking, bouncing balls, playing an instrument, and the lack of psychological emotiveness while still maintaining an overarching physicality, all are preceded by the task dance aesthetic. But Naumann's work is not just indebted to new dance in terms of movement, or rather its physical execution. By investigating the nature of movement and inventing new types of movement, the Judson dancers, as Cage had before them, and here my talk kind of dovetails with Nick's, and I'm just mapping up some lines of influence. I can't really go over this because I don't have time today, but I wanted to kind of flag this for everybody in the audience that you can read on your own. The Judson dancers, Ed's cage before them, equally had to reflect upon its notational aspects. As a result, the type, place, and function of the choreographic score, and again, the parallel with Cage is very important here. As a result, the type, place, and function of the choreographic score and the implicit hierarchy between score and dance, similar to the hierarchy that we think of between drawing and artwork, were revisited. From their first event, a concert of dance, scores were moved from the silent background, rising as the subject matter of dance. Dances became self-revealing exercises of staging choreography, as in Elaine Summers' Instant Chance, where dancers threw styrofoam blocks in the air during their performance. Shape determined the type of movement, color the speed, and number the rhythm. Other dancers took on the qualities of marking or rehearsing movement, which is typically what is done before the performance and then not seen during it. The attributes of scores themselves were also transformed from conventional notations describing qualities of movements to Cagean instructions or lists outlining actions to be performed, walk across the stage, pick up a ball. What philosopher and musicologist Daniel Charles in an essay on John Cage termed action notations that specify, quote, the gesture to be made rather than the result to be obtained, end quote. In their press release for A Concert of Dance, moreover, dancers and choreographers were listed together on equal footing with no distinction between them. Now, returning to Naumann's In Beckett Walk, the idea of movement as a form of notation can be discerned. His body goes through the paces of predetermined movements from the background to the foreground, creating invisible patterns upon the floor of the studio. If visualized, the traces would result in a series of geometrically inscribed lines, lines that we clearly see in the earlier studio films, where they are drawn on the floor with tape, creating a template for his body to follow so that he marks and performs his dance at the same time. In Beckett Walk, other inscriptions do appear. Marks on the floor, including a white line and Beck's black squiggly marks, a faint square on the back wall, and most prominently, the horizon line where floor meets wall, here rendered vertical through the rotation of the recording camera, so that the screen appears divided within. During the course of his performance, these traces become even more prominent, as during significant moments, Naumann completely disappears from view. Exiting the frame of the fixed camera for a total of 20 times in a 60-minute video, from mere seconds to a seemingly endless period of 4 minutes, where we see nothing but a blank screen filled with lines, and the video ends with a picture of Naumann's absence. The invisible pathways Naumann traces in Beckett Walk are, however, marked elsewhere. In the drawing that we saw at the beginning of my talk, where the sequences and combinations of movements are marked with lines, arcs, arrows, yielding a graphic pattern of geometrical forms. On top of the drawing, Naumann has written, right leg swings and steps, left leg pivot and step first, to swing, to right three times, then left three times, repeat. This same pattern then reappears in another drawing, Films with Sound, which also includes, which you can see, the leg swings. That's the Beckett Walk, which also includes the plan for Stamping in the Studio, a video made at the same time as Beckett Walk. Importantly, however, the drawing is entitled Beckett Walk Diagram, and I want to think about this use of the term diagram and not drawing. Line, rather than functioning in the traditional sense, i.e. the formal dichotomy of line and color, indicates something else, line as a form of bodily enactment. Drawing simultaneously is recast into another disciplinary matrix as a choreographic score. A score represents a sign system that linguistic philosophy terms performative language, in which signs do not describe, but produce actions or effects. A diagram indicates something to do. In other words, we use a diagram. I'll conclude with one final caveat or question. Did Naumann follow the score, or did the score follow Naumann? More than rhetorical, Slow Angle Walk, Beckett Walk, the video, is dated 1968. while the diagram is dated 1968 to 69, suggesting that at the time that he drew the diagram, he had already performed the movements in the video, and thus the temporal succession and hierarchy of drawing to completed artwork is inverted or dislodged, saying something quite different about the temporality and the status of drawing itself. Naumann himself suggests as much in a letter from 1973 to Count Giuseppe Panza di Buomo, who was a major collector of Naumann's architectural installations from the late 60s and early 70s, which only exist as a drawing until they're installed. So in other words, Panza did not buy this. He bought the plan. Responding to Panza's concern about Naumann's tendency to produce multiple proliferating drawings of the installations, and of course Panza didn't own them all, Naumann writes, "There are many drawings made before and during the construction of a piece as the idea develops. Some drawings are made after completion of a piece to realize the way the piece functions versus the initial thoughts." End quote. As explanatory or functional, Naumann's Beckett walk diagram might be said to reinterpret or remake the video, allowing us to see his performance through the notational space of line. In so doing, it announces a certain equivalence, based not on shared medium, but in the shared commitment to reiteration. Drawings that are to be made over and over, a video that can be copied and repeated endlessly. The work is always incomplete or in potentia. There is no final artwork. In drawing, we find the very logic of Naumann's art. Thank you.
An argument in an array of costumed subterfuge. A 100-year-old man from Mississippi, me in a rabbit suit representing Br'er Rabbit, an unreliable narrator, storyteller, liar, both of us masking our specific cultural bodies and politics. Falling black bodies from the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Bruce Naumann. Me in my studio, out of the rabbit suit, thinking about Bruce Naumann and the 100-year-old man and nothing. Me back in the rabbit suit, now pretending to be broken, running with a limp. I lost the argument, perhaps. I think the argument is, actually it's not really an argument. Most of us that have the privilege to mask our cultural bodies and politics, we can make some kind of art. Or we embody something beyond ourselves because we have to, and call that embodiment whatever we want to call it. I had to get permission from Naumann to use that 8-second clip. The archival footage from the civil rights movement was available free. It didn't seem to have any ownership. It was the second time I had contacted Naumann. The first time was in 2002, a letter I wrote through the Walker Art Center, the only way I could contact him. I know this is not an event about Bruce Naumann, but bear with me, I think the line will connect, I hope. I suppose one could think of Naumann in this context as some kind of Br'er Rabbit. To whom it may concern. There's much I could say about this request. There are many layers, but I will try to keep it simple. I first saw wall floor positions at the Whitney Biennial, 8 years ago? I was floored. I've been experimenting with movement for most of my life, and viewing this performance, bodywork, film, video, stunned most of what I thought I knew about moving. I did some research and discovered that Naumann did indeed make dances, sort of. Naumann's dances from the 60s are fascinating to me for their commitment and rigor to an amateur movement art dance perspective, the simplicity and obvious commitment to the task, and how they differ from the work of the Judson Church dance canon, postmodern dance of the same period. That his dances surface to be more about being human, untrained, than about being anything else. And there was the important timeline, placement of these works. If my reading serves me correctly, Naumann created a version of wall floor positions in 1965, the same year Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, and the same year Tricia Brown created Homemade, a seminal postmodern dance work. The 1968 film version of wall floor positions was made the year of Martin Luther King's assassination. These seemingly disparate events are a defining and fraught part of my history as an artist and racial being. What specifically interests me about wall floor positions, beyond its obvious relationship to art and the body, the beautifully ordinary and rigorous movement statement that it is the not-so-obvious parallel realities of a period of time of a Western white male art freedom and the Black Civil Rights Movement. I would posit that at the time, Naumann embodied this concept gloriously. Body is art, material, body is chattel. Where and how did these forces intersect beyond an inanimate sociology of walls and floors? Was that possible? Does it matter? My partner in this potential venture is J.J. Gervais, a dance artist from Côte d'Ivoire, West Africa. I've been collaborating with J.J. since 1997. Since our first meeting, his and my bodies have taken on a very interesting and useful idea about American modernity as tradition and West African tradition as something always modern. We are coming to separate but equal simple terms. I could go on, but won't. My hope is that Naumann will send us detailed instructions to the original work, or new instructions that we would then follow. Our plan and participation in this recreation is to place our physical history and body art politics in what I feel is a historically major movement work about a body negotiating a wall and a floor, and how that work is representative of now and perhaps what it represented then. And it would be a recreation, not a transition, not a translation. Of course, JJ and I bring different bodies, trainings, understandings, and cultures and time elements to what Naumann originally intended. All the better. After all, it's 2002, not 1965 or 68. Nevertheless, it will essentially remain what Naumann structured. That is my hope. My only request beyond permission to recreate wall floor positions is to have a freestanding wall so that JJ and I could perform the work simultaneous on either side of the wall, holding a conversation with Naumann's intended wall and floor and with each other. Naumann, if it interests him, could also newly structure what this simultaneity is, should be. As far as crediting the performance, we would be performing a Naumann work, unless there's more specific credit that Naumann desires. Let me know if I've left anything out. Thank you, Ralph. A month later, I got a response, again through the walker. Just spoke with Juliet in Bruce's studio, and she said that his response is a definitive yes, in quotes. Regarding how Bruce would like to be acknowledged, Juliet said that language such as, after Bruce Naumann's wall floor positions, 1965, is fine. Something right along those lines. What strikes me now about this exchange is the question mark after the date from Naumann and his one-word answer to my very long request. Wall floor remains a work within a certain cultural freedom of being, a privilege, and what I would call a paradance. Not really a dance, but emphatically about the body experimenting with itself, with time and space, elegantly desperate. It seems so simple. I, on the other hand, find much useful fodder in the mashup of anything I can appellate about myself, inherited, remembered, imagined, mythologized, embodied. Most of what I conjure can activate a practice, my body, desperately. The connective tissue, the lines are not so simple. I draw every day. These drawings perhaps have nothing to do with the performance work, and in that respect, they ground the performance work because of their privacy. They are paradances, movement drawings. Who knows?
Thanks. My short talk is entitled The Stain and the Diagram, Two Models of the Ends of Drawing, and it addresses the manifest tendency or program of the exhibition to recuperate and recover a transition from drawing to spatial performative activities in the 60s, a tendency that is extraordinary in the moment of its initial emergence in the 60s, and a tendency that is extraordinary in the moment of recuperation, but a tendency that is also problematical if it is not reflected upon why it is recuperated upon in the present moment. A colleague of mine recently in a conference said that compulsion to total participation is the final state of total spectacularization. And I think that is a dimension of the recovery of the 1960s that should be inserted into the reflection process on this tendency. It is not only out of the spirit of the contrarian that I will focus in the following on the few epistemes of drawing that seem to have been somewhat occluded in the exhibition online and its otherwise nearly encyclopedic ambitions. Rather, it seems to me that the historical examples that I will discuss point to a fundamental and important set of contradictions that have made the scope of drawing in the 20th century even far more complex than the exhibition might have us believe. I'm showing you Francis Picabia's 1920 Sainte-Verge. Or more precisely, I want to zero in into some thresholds, different thresholds, where drawing turned into non-drawing, into anti-drawing, where it performed the negation of gesture and mark-making altogether, not where it turned into dance. It seems that these instances did not just signal utopian aspirations throughout the 20th century, which the tenor of online would want us to believe, but they signaled a dialectical counter-paradigm of pessimism and critical negativity. Clearly, the driving dynamics of online wants to convince us that drawing in various crucial instances shifted from the mere mark-making processes of the subject articulating itself with a variety of tools in the spaces of surfaces to an actualization of a performing body in public space. That means gestures expand the process of drawing itself, and the spatial conception shifts from the surface to actual three-dimensional space, be it the presumably abstract space of the singular dancer or of choreography, or be it the more concrete space of performative interventions in social relations. I do not in the least doubt the historical seduction of these propositions, neither the gratification that they yielded to those performers and audiences in the mid-1960s that had actual access to those performances. But I want to sketch out some of the countermodels where drawing articulates containment and control, where it formulates the rapidly disappearing options of the subject to place and position itself in the world, or even to still find access to residual mark-making processes in private or public spaces and surfaces, to remnants of gesture and inscription, futile or fertile. I could begin with Guillaume Apollinaire's famous declaration about having made white gestures in empty spaces, to get straight to the heart of the dialectics of drawing and gesture in the 20th century. On the one hand, the subject is driven by an ever-intensifying desire to collectivize the access to the articulation of the self. On the other, it is confronted with the no less intense and perpetual insight that access to the subject's self-realization is rapidly disappearing from everyday life and from social forms of communication and exchange under the intense impact and control exerted by mass cultural forms of representation. More concretely, I could cite one of the first instances after Cubism where this dialectic is forcefully formulated in the work of Francis Picabia, the image that I'm currently showing. I would call it the opposition between the stain and the diagram, or the stain and the cut, as two mutually enforcing counter-strategies that negate the continuing validity of any belief in drawing as gesture of articulating the agency of subjectivity. On the one hand, the stain anticipates the dream of automatism. On the one hand, the stain anticipates the dream of automatism, which would soon thereafter find its climactic articulations in surrealism. It is the dream of total de-skilling, of drawing, and of everybody speaking for and for themselves, which surrealist automatism aimed to accomplish. Furthermore, and not accidentally, it was surrealism that had discovered the immense promises of the graffito, where this utopian hope seemed to have already reached its first and public manifestation, that everybody could and would draw from the drives of the unconscious, could and would draw from the anonymity of the outsider, could and would draw from the outside of class, yet to make a public mark to be present and presented and to be counted. Ever since the matrix of the graffito has haunted modern and postmodern drawing practices as one of the irrepressible countervoices of drawing. And Picabia's stain, called Sainte Vierge, signals a second, possibly even more radical message about drawing in the 20th century. That among the many modes of de-skilling drawing and disabling the mythical agency of the draftsman's virtuoso performance of paper, chance and aleatory principles would play a new and immensely more important role, not just by enforcing de-skilling, but also by enacting total disfiguration. Chance disables, if not annihilates, the subject's agency and its desire for agency and representation altogether. Therefore, an unresolvable contradiction emerges at the heart of the most radical contestations of drawing in the very first moment. To enact collective articulation and to annihilate it publicly at the same time. To point to the haphazardly executed smear or stain as the beginning of a new collectivity of these skilled forms of articulation, and to reveal them as travesties of the desire to situate and position oneself in public space and social visibility through powerful anonymous marks. These, alas, as it turns out to be true for the graffito as well, they remain ultimately powerless gestures of fumbling in the void, of marking voided spaces where neither subjects nor strategies ultimately matter, and therefore where the claim to have access to the public has become a pure travesty from the very beginning. The second element of Picabia's anti-drawing manifesto from 1920, no less obscenely titled Jeune Fille, an aspect that George Baker has given enough attention to, so I don't have to repeat it here, is the definition of the cut in Jeune Fille in 1920. The circular removal from the surface of the support, the perforation of the surface itself, the withdrawal of the mark by the substitution of a void, all of these strategies are formulated here for the first time, and they will reverberate in variations and differentiations from Pollock's cutout of the 50s to Lucio Fontana all the way down to Lawrence Wiener's strategies of defining drawing as removals in the early 1960s. And indeed, the spatial cut, the negation of surface, activates drawing in a variety of ways, but not necessarily as the exhibition would want us to make us believe, by leading into a trajectory of emancipatory and liberating bodily performative gestures. What was the chaos of the stain in Sainte Vierge, the uncontrollable expansion of pigment according to the laws of gravity and chance, the principle that would guide once again major drawings and structures from Pollock to Serra, is formulated here in the cut as the dialectical opposite in the mechanical stencil, as the matrix of the perforation. And in both instances, it is through the evidence, or rather the ostentatious lack thereof, of the bodily trace in drawing, that the failure of the subject and the failure of the collectivity to articulate and represent themselves in the gesture and the action, mark-making processes becomes manifest, or that they are made to appear as travesties of utopian aspirations performed in the registers of the anti-drawing itself. This dialectic is, of course, played out with renewed intensity, perhaps with less cynicism than in Picabia, primarily in the works of American artists after the Second World War. Robert Rauschenberg's Erased de Kooning drawing performs precisely that dialectic with the ostentatious precision of a manifesto. Here, once again, artistic gesture, skill is annihilated. Yet the accidental stain of what once was gesture remains. And the gesture that dislodges gesture is the gesture of the pure negation of drawing, the erasure. It suspends the mythical claims for the subject's agency that had regained such centrality in the context of post-surrealist automatism in the works of the New York School painters. Drawing from now on, that is the mid-50s onwards, at least in some of its major examples, will lead from Rauschenberg's Erased de Kooning drawing to his illustrations for Dante's Inferno. And it will lead to Jasper Johns's magisterial and melancholic meditations on the minute structures of the smallest unit of drawing, the mere grapheme. And drawing is now executed in a space where no aspiration and action seem possible at all anymore. Drawing will now be perpetually suspended within this dialectic of negation. It will signal the absence of a subject and the absence of a performing body. It becomes nothing but the public enactment of the conditions of total control and containment. This tendency will reach one more formulation in Warhol's drawings of the early 1960s. And it is not all accidental that these drawings are again deeply indebted to Picabia's early invocations of the matrix as an inescapable structure within which the subject's desire and the desire for subjectivity are contained. Most eminent and most applicable as a counterstatement to the optimistic embrace of the transition from drawing to the spatial performative that the exhibition celebrates, Warhol's dance diagrams from 1961-62 enact precisely the failure of that delusion. Or they anticipate the future of the deception that the bodily expansion of drawing would lead to a different type of subjective and collective representation. Displaying the very models of dancing, traditionally the quintessence of liberated libidinal subjectivity in ritual and ecstasy, as an industrially prefigured social construction, drawings by Warhol are not only retroactively bemoaning the false promises of Pollock's dance that he had given us in the resuscitation of automatism, but it is also looking forward, Warhol is, to the deceptive promises that a universal enactment of Cajun aesthetic of radical contingency would bring about. Thus, when Warhol placed his dance diagram paintings on the ground so as to seemingly invite participatory performative action by the spectators, so as to seemingly argue that there is a liberation to be expected from the transition from the surface of the paper and the canvas to the surfaces of social space, it is precisely the cancellation of that promise that we find first and foremost articulated in that gesture and in that displacement. Thank you.
I'm not sure exactly where to start. but thank you all. I think that the sort of range of remarks here is really a testament to, in fact, the kind of difficulty of coming to terms with this notion of movement and line, dance and drawing. I want to actually go back, before I have some specific questions for each of you, to Ralph as the one maker here in the group. And to this idea that I kind of began my remarks with that came out of the earlier discussion about, I guess, beginnings and initial marks, when Luis mentioned earlier the making of a point as a connection to the real. And Ralph, in your talk, as I thought you would do, you spoke sort of around process and actual movement and work in a way. But I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about actually the kind of movement that you make and how it's initiated. I know it's difficult to describe it in the absence of it, but if you can just expand a little bit.
Well, at this moment in time, it's an argument. It's how, for me, to kind of collapse movement in how I know it. And perhaps it's just what happens after one deals with a particular practice over a long period of time. You begin to see a form, and that form becomes, takes on a kind of tyranny of habit, or I know it, or my body does it without thinking about it. It's inside my body. It's also a problem compositionally. And so for me, it's become really important to think about like how to erase that, I think, which is a lot of what was spoken of in the first drawing panel. However, with the body, it's quite difficult because the body is the body, and it's limited in what it can do and can't do. And I would love to have my body disappear and reappear. So I can't do that, but how can I almost do that, with a body, without dying? Which is starting to really interest me also. that there is that experience. But more in practical terms, the argument then becomes the fodder. Because I think in my more recent work, you see this tension of my trying to erase composition in the body as I know it. And it's fraught and not easy, very contentious, in how I think about serving my own body practice and how I work with performers and collaborators. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that sort of danced around the question too.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk just a bit more, and then we can open it up, about the relationship of drawing to the works and to the choreographic process?
Well, this part I'm finding extremely interesting because as someone who's been on stage for many, many years, there's this, this big question of what is an audience? And yet there's something inherent about an audience to performance, whether one is really addressing that or not. Mm-hmm. And I kind of keep it really playful. Like I never really want to know what that relationship is personally. I like the strangeness and the mystery of it. And my drawing practice is just something I've done more in more of my life than I have as a movement performing artist. And so it has a very important privacy. I think of it as it's meditation for me. Because there's no tyranny of audience. It's just me drawing. And that privacy is extremely fulfilling, compositionally, and the physical enactment, and it seems very holistic. And I like that there's not a showing element to it, other than like for my friends or private audiences. So there's something very clean about my relationship to it. That I don't have to dilect.
I was thinking about the, not in terms of privacy so much, but Nick, when you were talking about the Fluxus works and the Lamont Young in particular, the way that line exists almost in a pre-performed or sort of private state, and then seeing the people as we were sitting there watching the screen of the Pake, the sort of blank screen of that, and thinking of that moment or that activity of viewing it as because we're looking at sort of nothing, and but also looking at a line moving across. I wonder if you could talk, because you spoke about the line, but not so much about drawing, but about if if in your thinking about Paik, if at all those works have a kind of equivalency to in the process and how the film is manipulated, as being a kind of equivalency to drawing, to an act of.
Well, I think in these works, in some ways you could read Zen for Film as a kind of enactment of Lamont Young's Draw a Straight Line and Follow It. Mm-hmm. And Paik did perform in my original presentation that was over 10 minutes long. I had Paik doing Zen for Head, mm-hmm. which is his performance of Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, yeah. as a kind of counter cage piece in which he unrolls a long sheet of paper, dips his hair in red paint, mm-hmm. and crawls backwards. And I think there's an illustration of that in the exhibition and the catalogue. Yep. And what it's a demonstration of is a kind of violent variation of the straight line, the impossibility of acting out the straight line. And I think it's the connection between the enactment of the straight line and the act of drawing is that kind of decentering. Mm-hmm. And where that's expressed in Lamont Young is the fact that the straight line or the continuous sound, when you inhabit it, is a process of a kind of infinite variation where your own experience is at the center of the work, but it's constantly changing, and so there is no center to the work. Mm-hmm. And in Paik, this becomes quite elaborate, because what he's trying, to my mind, although this is where questions of intention become quite difficult, but in what it's doing or in its effect, it's decentering the time of the work. So it's decentering your time in the work. And insofar as it's a mirror of who you are as a subject, it actually moves toward, to my mind, the kind of things that Benjamin was talking about, which is, where is the subject? If you don't have your time in the work, but if you are a function of the many times of the work, if the times are multiple, then actually it fragments the subject, and it's quite a disturbing mirror. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is unlike, to my mind, unlike Cage, who is centered within Zen, which kind of answers the question of where it's going. And much of the work that Cage influences actually unravels itself to the world in quite a disturbing way, mm-hmm. and departs from the centeredness of Cage, to my mind. So the act of drawing then becomes something that's continually displacing itself. I mean, it's, and that's what's evident in Tricia Brown. It's not a dance, and it's not a drawing. It's somewhere between those things, mm-hmm. and that is the point. And so it raises a lot of questions about any kind of resolution of the self into an expressive gesture, because the gesture is always before or after itself. It belongs to somebody else, mm-hmm. in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that really answers the question, but the act is... The interesting thing to me in the end is that the act of drawing means that it's neither the drawing nor the act.
Yeah.
It lies somewhere.
Which is the kind of equivalency that Janet was talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to elaborate on that, Janet? Or Benjamin?
On what?
On this kind of equivalency that you started to lay out at the very end of the act and the drawing itself.
I'm not sure I know how to answer that. I don't know if there's so much an equivalency in my mind as a way of thinking very differently about it, about when, and I'm just going to stick to what I was talking about. I mean, part of my work stems from thinking, what are the implications of when Naumann uses his own body to perform something? And I've been kind of a contrarian, writing against the way that the performing body in the visual arts was tied to a subject and subjectivity, because for me, his work is really radically against that. It's so radically depersonalized. And so less than equivalency, it's more than thinking that, as opposed to the body being this kind of material, natural, biological self, and then we have something else over there that's conceptual or, you know, operates in a different, in a linguistic way. There's a kind of collapse or a pressure plate placed upon both of those terms in his work. And so my interest in kind of thinking about where the trajectory of where he goes with it is, first is the aesthetic that he presents when he performs,
Second, that it's never live, that it's never in front of an audience except for the one example that Ralph mentioned, the first wall floor positions and manipulating a fluorescent tube that he performed live as a graduate student in 1965 at UC Davis. He recreates them in video in 1968. And that even that gesture of wanting it to be a recording and not a live act, the fact that he rarely performed live and then stopped using his own body because of this equivalence that was constantly, I think, being rendered, and displaces it onto the viewer. But I guess encounter, or kind of stem, elaborating upon what some of what Benjamin was saying, is that Naumann, to me, his engagement of the viewer is never for any form of, you know, emancipation. It's really a radically cynical, controlling.
That's the word.
Not cynical. Controlling gesture that is the opposite of that form of emancipation.
Yeah, I mean, I was also curious, Benjamin, about your. I don't know if you actually said emancipatory, but
I did.
You did, yeah. That your reading of the exhibition is kind of leading up to that point, and that point being specifically emancipatory.
Okay. Well, I think Janet laid out one very crucial historical transition by saying the drawing shifts to the diagram, and the diagram is a solicitation of a performative operation, and that defines the historical difference. I think that is a very crucial clarification. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important for us to remember how, and you didn't have the time to do this, but of course you do this otherwise, how Naumann's work situates itself explicitly within a sculptural context of minimalism, right?
Yeah, I can't do that here.
Right, obviously not. But we might as well recall it here for a moment that this is directly aiming at displacing traditional definitions of sculptural production, among other things. He does many things, but that is clearly Flavin and Judd, I think, are Naumann's bête noire that he clearly confronts with what he does. Mm-hmm. And that is what I would call the radical dimension of Naumann's performativity, that he completely dismantles the notion of what a sculptural object is and relocates it in the body. No means in a manner that would be emancipatory, but unless the Enlightenment itself is emancipatory, right? Which I think it is, ultimately. When it comes to other disciples who come out of the Halperin workshop, as he does as well, again, we should mention that quickly. Yes. Of course, you know that, right? I mean, he comes out of the same dance workshop where Yvonne Rainer and Simon Forti had worked. When it comes to the other figures, Yvonne in particular, and that's, I think, fantastic to see in this exhibition, of course, the radicality of dismantling traditional models of dance and choreography has an emancipatory quality for me, always has had. It's an enormous step forward. It's an enormous step into a different register of perceiving the body and perceiving movement and perceiving social space. But what I'm criticizing, if anything, if that's the right word even, is that this historical transition is now recaptured or recuperated as though it was accessible in the present moment and it could be mobilized for the present. Because when it is mobilized for the present, it has been completely transformed, and that's why I was introducing my paper with this remark about to what degree is the mythical claim for participatory models historically transformed in the present moment. And I think that's not necessarily the task of an exhibition because you are dealing with historical objects, but the subtext of the exhibition reads to me as though you're pointing into the direction of how these moments of clear historical emancipation could be recaptured in the present by resuscitating, imitating, inviting continuation. And that's really the criticism that I wanted to hint at. I think, and that would be a good conversation to have, I'm not sure whether we can do this right now, I think Judson School and Naumann, as related as they are really doing different things ultimately.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No, I mean, the spirit of Yvonne Rainer is a very different spirit from Naumann.
Absolutely.
I don't think Naumann is cynical, but Naumann is not for nothing calling it Beckett work. Right?
And Yeah.
3OA is an extraordinary emancipatory performance for me still.
Yeah, I mean, I don't make any claims that he's doing the same thing.
Right.
But I think the I mean, first the connection to Halperin, which, you know, Naumann in the question mark with the date won't right. answer specifically, really. His knowledge of. Right. He was in Northern California. That was, he knew Meredith Monk right. later on. He was aware of Judson. I was talking about what, I mean, my question for me is, he's not doing the same thing, because first of all, he's not performing a dance in front of an right. audience. He's filming it, which I make a big deal of, because right. I think it's incredibly important that you're seeing something that's completely mediated and that is looped in a way that you cannot have access to in a live performance. A live performance can maybe exist for 24 hours if you're Lamont Young, but Naumann's is intended to exist forever. It just goes on and on and on and on, and it will never stop, and it's never going to be able to stop because it's recorded, not because it's live. But the question for me is why he appropriates very explicitly that vocabulary of the body for his dance. And it's anti-expressive and anti-narrative and all of those things.
And anti-sculptural.
Anti-sculptural?
Well,
I think Simon Forti is very sculptural.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Naumann.
Naumann. Yes. Oh, anti-sculptural in the yes. traditional sense. Yes, 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 yes. And to back to your point of the engagement with minimalism.
Yeah.
So if you're going to take minimalism and try to dismantle minimalism, and he looks to this kind of task dance aesthetic mm-hmm. and very self-consciously incorporates it, and also Cage. Cagean kinds mm-hmm. of negation that comes in there. So that was, to me, the interesting question of, you know, what are the implications of using that type of bodily presentation that locks down any kind of psychological access to the performer, which is a very, very, very different gesture than yeah. some other artists who right. start using their body during...
But it also locks down, and this is where I think Ralph's presentation was wonderful for me, because I confess I don't know your work well enough. I was really, really happy to learn about it. That what Naumann locks down is, of course, also the dimension of historicity. Mm-hmm. Right? With 30 years hindsight, now we see this, and it looks very much like abstract sculpture, mm-hmm. paradoxically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, in the greatest... I say this with the greatest admiration. And the same way that Yvonne Rainer at some point says, I'm not going to continue to do this. I'm going to make a film now, and my film is going to become one of the most important interventions in feminist activation and theory, yeah. right? She makes a break that Naumann, I don't know, does he make the break? Perhaps he does in some ways. But certainly, if we see the juxtaposition between Ralph's work and Naumann's work, we see exactly what was precisely the historical limitation mm-hmm. of Naumann's own radicality. Right? Mm. But it was not an emancipatory strategy that I agree
yeah, but
with.
I guess I would say, I would just say that I think the degree of engaging participation as a form of control and dependency that he does has a kind of social
right.
critique.
Okay, it does. Yeah.
That's, for me, it's not...
Which is a lot at that
it's
time.
It's not a political content.
Yeah, which is a lot at the yeah. time if you compare it to Flavin,
yeah.
for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then later on in the 70s, he incorporates very specific political references
yeah.
with those same types of strategies in the work.
I think we should probably move it off of Naumann a little
yes.
bit.
Well,
thank God.
I mean, or we can just, or not. Why don't we open it up?
He's a cipher.
Yeah. Which is sort of how, when we spoke, why I reacted the way I did, it was sort of, I mean, I think what I said is you can't have an exhibition like this actually and not have him, but I just hadn't sort of addressed it yet.
Well, in line with your request to move it away from Naumann. I thought it would be nice to underline the Leah Clark's work in your show. I did only saw half of the show, but I know that the piece is there, the trailing from 1964, because in terms of being a radically anti-sculptural practice, she certainly fits the bill. In terms of emancipation, I think she's a very interesting case, and this probably applies to several artists in South America, part of this sort of neo-concrete or as part of a move, an engagement with constructivism and concrete art, but also, you know, a dialogue that is a distanciation from a lot of these, you know, European legacies. Because she is, for example, in that work, when you read the accompanying text, she's certainly citing what reads as an emancipatory project. Yeah. She talks about a fusion of the subject with the object. Yet, you know, in reconsidering the Mobius strip, which is this topological figure that has been introduced into the Brazilian context by Max Bill, you know, you end up with this shred of paper that is obviously an impossibility, mm-hmm. An impossibility of, you know, embodying, finding a referent for these aspiration to a fusion between subject and object. I mean, the later work, it's, you know, it's for no, it's by not by coincidence called Nostalgia do Corpo, Nostalgia of the Body, mm-hmm. And she constantly is writing about this sort of precariousness of the self, precariousness of the body, and there's, yeah, probably a longing, but yet when it deploys itself in the materiality of the work, it just doesn't resolve. There's a constant preoccupation with decentering, with dispersal, that I think complicates things in terms of thinking of a dialectics between, you know, emancipatory and mm-hmm. and criticality, or emancipation and negativity. That there are cases in which the things are complicated and can't be necessarily located in one pole or the other.
Thank you. I mean, I think that was part of our attempt in that part of the exhibition to at least imply some other kind of model where we had, you know, where there is Rainer and Trisha Brown and Naumann, but also the Caminando and the Bichos to sort of try to get at what begins as a kind of emancipatory project right at that moment, and then I think does other things as well. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed evolving over recent years is the construction of performance history out of art history with some moments of dance history put in. And I'm curious that there seems to be an avoidance of theatrical theory in this construction of the history of performance. If you take a figure like Wilson, who draws everything, you know, it might be a way to think about this in terms of theater. How is it that his drawing practice, which has been so phenomenal in drawing everything, and in fact he's recently drawn the performance, which he will stage, The Life and Death of Marina Abramović, how is it that he's not a part of this history, or why is theater and theatrical theory so little a part of the thinking of performance history in the museum? It seems to be that case, with just a few, you know, exceptions here and there. I'm just curious about this development. Do you think it might, the two fields might come closer together in the future?
I don't think they will here. I mean, I think there is a history though at MoMA of there was actually a dance or a dance and theater arts. I believe I'm right about this, Leah. Maybe you remember. Department that was started in the 40s, and it existed for a very brief time, and there's actually a whole collection, in fact, in drawings of works that we call it the theater art collection, I think. And it's there was an exhibition a number of months ago that my colleague Jody Hopman did, actually, that did include Robert Wilson's drawings among, you know, many other Leon Bachs and, you know, all the way back in the century. So it's something that we have the capacity to deal with a little bit, but part of, I think, the reason that department was disbanded is because it was just decided at that moment that we wouldn't deal with the theater arts, and so we don't. But I think, as far as why it's not represented in the exhibition, I don't know if that's your... Okay. Yeah.
I'd like to ask those of you who have been thinking about drawing and performance and dance, how you might speak about the models in the earlier part of the century. You know, models like Laban or Wigman or Nijinsky. There are Nijinsky drawings in the show.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really interested in Wigman and Laban, and particularly because of their roles as teachers of people like Gret Paluca and others, and also because of their sort of invention of notational drawing as a way of recording dance movement. And we decided, I think, right from the beginning, and I believe that there is this real difference between dance notation and the kind of drawing that we're trying to map in the exhibition, and the whole conception of line in both of those things. And Nijinsky is really, I mean, he's a funny case in the exhibition just because I think Catherine and I both, you know, his work as a visual artist and drawing is not, in fact, so interesting. And that one little drawing that we have is quite lovely, but he's not, I think he's there more as just a sort of marker of that moment. So I don't know if...
Can I say something to this?
Yeah.
Even though it's probably the public's turn, but...
No, quickly. Please.
I would really like to benefit from your presence to grasp more the interest of Tricia Brown's drawings that you showed today, for example. I think that's a very good example. Is it really so productive for all of us to de-differentiate the spheres of competence at all times? Hmm. Right? As radical a project as
to
that...
To de-differentiate.
Yes, to de-differentiate the spheres of competence. Because radical as that was at some point, we have to recognize that there are different historical tendencies and dynamics that might not make the sphere, the de-differentiation of spheres as radical as it was in the 1965 moment, right? Mm-hmm. So when I see Tricia Brown, whom I admire endlessly, I think her Orfeo by Monteverdi was one of the greatest experiences I've had in the last 20 years. So it's not at all about criticizing Tricia Brown, and everything I've seen by her is absolutely extraordinary. But when I see her do the drawings that you showed in this film today, I thought, what is she doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
I mean, is it going back to the legacy of Jackson Pollock, but 50 years later, when the legacy of Jackson Pollock has been completely transformed by endless thoughts about what this means? I mean, what am I supposed to do with this? Is this automatism reborn? Is this... I really cannot understand why this woman is doing this. Not at all. I mean, absolutely not. And I would like to have somebody in the audience or here tell me to come back to my total boundless admiration for Tricia Brown. Could you?
Connect.
I mean, since you showed it, yeah.
I'm not going to persuade you to like Tricia Brown.
No, I love Tricia Brown, this. No, I don't understand why she would do this.
Yeah. No, I can say.
I can understand why she did.
I would say one thing, just one thing, which picks up on Bonnie's point that we've made around where's theatre, which is there is a certain history of performance that moves between these spheres.
Right.
And I don't think it's interesting to de-differentiate the spheres. I think it's interesting to see that thread going through it. And from my point of view, coming from performance itself, if you like, as an interest, it's the way performance is transformed, made different, the way that it can then inhabit other kinds of areas of activity.
Right.
As a practice, which complicates your view of it, which complicates and tends to unravel and be in dialogue with your expectations around forms, that's the interest. Right. So it's certainly not about de-differentiating, but seeing those conversations, which then extend very directly into forms of theatre practice. After all, you know, Wilson's work is peppered with contributions by members of the Judson Dance and so on.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what does Tricia Brown offer in 2003, re-performing in some ways a certain kind of aesthetic that was created between 1962 and 64, I think that I personally find it, you know, in that sense, I get something from it in the performance itself. But I think there is a, if I can just throw in a different question, which is, which underlies some of the discussion to my mind, which is there has been a tendency recently to re-perform participatory works from the early 60s in a kind of historical vacuum, as if that work provides an abstract moment of emancipation,
right,
which I actually am not clear was necessarily left uncritiqued in the work's original forms. And there's a kind of social and historical abstraction that's then replayed as an experience in a bubble. And I think that's problematic and picks up very directly, I think, you know, on what you were saying
right
before. I don't see that problem so much in what Tricia Brown is doing, but I do see it in to some extent, while finding it absolutely fascinating, in, say, Marina Abramovich's Seven Easy Pieces, which makes work available
that in some respects was never available in the first place. So that's the kind of re-performance that I think is troubled, but maybe it's maybe part of it's what it's doing is being troubling.
I think it's for Tricia more simple. I know for a fact her drawing makes her feel good.
That's fine.
So I think where it becomes complicated is when it enters a canon of relevancy of is it important?
Right.
But to who?
Yes.
I mean, I think those become really interesting questions.
I mean, drawing is a disciplinary formation that is as complicated as philosophy. Right. If somebody walks up to me and say, I'm going to now make an opera of analytic philosophy, I say, well, good luck. It might not work out, right? So if somebody who is not in all capable of drawing or knows the history of drawing suddenly enters the disciplinary formation of drawing and says, I'm going to make drawings now because I'm an artist with a body who can do drawings, I said, all right, let's take a look at what this does to the disciplinary formation and the history of drawing and its reflection.
No, like, I mean,
that seems a legitimate question.
I think it is. I mean, but you also have to look at where her drawing practice comes from. It doesn't just start with those body drawings, as you know. I mean, it goes back to she's been drawing her whole career. So for her, there is this equivalency. I mean, that's how she talks about it, of dance and drawing always. And the early, I forget if you showed one or not, but these early works where it's a, you know, they're locus drawings where there's the square and then she's actually tracking her own movements. They are notational. They don't look like dance drawings, but that's actually what they are.
But if they are notational drawings, that's a totally different matter. Nobody would ever challenge that. But these drawings that we saw today, these are not notational drawings.
One could say that you're replaying the Charge of Judson, because one could say that Steve Paxton's Walking is a dance, which, of course, was said in 1963.
Right. Yeah.
So is Tricia Brown's drawing drawing?
A drawing, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it isn't.
Well, if it's used with a pencil on paper, it's most likely trying to be a drawing.
Well, it's an act.
Because it's not a notation that designs choreography or organization. It's clearly... No? I mean, is there another way of reading it?
The continuity might lie in the problematic that is reflected in your objection to Brown's drawing, in the same way that when we see Paxton orchestrating various walks across the stage, one can say, well, look, it's entered into the realm of dance, and dance is an accomplished area of activity, but frankly, this isn't very accomplished. Now, that doesn't mean that...
No, that's the opposite.
It doesn't mean
it's
that
precisely
Tricia Brown's,
the opposite.
It doesn't mean that Tricia Brown's drawing are necessarily satisfying if what you want is a high degree of articulation of its place within, you know, the aesthetic and historical practice of drawing. In the same way that Paxton's Walking might be unsatisfying if you want to go and see a certain kind of dance.
You misunderstood me, because Paxton's Walk is radical de-skilling, and that's what makes it so extraordinary.
Sure.
And Tricia Brown's new drawings are re-skilling, and that is the problem.
I think they're more akin to radical de-skilling, actually.
Really?
I mean, when you look at her doing them, I mean, you can't help but think otherwise, right? It's almost like she's lost the function of her body.
Judson made drawings other than notational drawings. Right? What do you end up with? You end up with a piece of paper.
Well, you also end up with...
I kept thinking of Janine Antoni. I don't know. That was my reference for it.
Sorry.
And I think that Benjamin in the...
Hi.
I think that there is a clear, tension between indexicality and notation in the drawings, first of all. I mean, I don't think you can think of them as purely notational drawings. I think that they have a complicated relationship with the notion of the diagram, what comes before and after in terms of what Janet described for Naumann. I think that the drawings are obviously forcing her to move in a certain way, so they might really break a certain automatism of her bodily movements, so they might allow her to basically create movements almost accidentally that she wouldn't do if the drawing would not be there, blocking her automatism. I think that there's also a tension between, you know, what you could call automatism and intentionality, that it's very clearly seen in the performance. There's moments in which she's sort of like tries to unravel, tries to unravel and compress and decompress a line. I think that all of that is clearly there. So,
okay.
But it is true that when we, I mean, when we decided to include one of those, I went to the studio and it was hanging on the wall, and I thought, finally one of them that actually looks great.
You know,
like, we can do it. It's okay. We can put it on the, you know, and she struggled also, I know, with how to display them. And when she first started making them, her idea was to show them on the ground, which might have changed in some way how we understand what they are, you know. But now they're framed, which we didn't also expect it to show framed, which is a whole, and now that's how she wants them to be seen. But
I wonder if quite a good answer to this is Carolee Schneemann's Up to and Including Her Limits, which occupies a certain kind of physical and painterly space, but retains the actions within the installation. So, because the point from my point of view, what interests me about Brown's performance is the fact that it very beautifully put by the previous speaker, that it is about a process, and it's about a line or in time or an act of drawing, and its resolution is less interesting than the process which you can't be separated from.
I just like to say, for me, as someone who has been sort of moving and looking at moving for a long time, when I look at that, I see Tricia prone experimenting with her body, like she always has, more vertically. And the lines just become traces of that. And I think that's where it maybe perhaps becomes problematic. It's like leaving those traces as works.
Well, she's looking at them very consciously.
Yeah, but if you really watch the body, you know, because she's been moving for so many years so brilliantly and you know, as a genius, I think, without question, that the body takes on a certain kind of energetically, there's sort of an activator there that's happening beyond kind of the thinking. And I would
almost... That's not a relapse into automatist mythologies?
I don't know, but I would say but I would say the lines are coming out as an afterthought.
There's an important part of Tricia Brown's work, which is about not simply presenting the act or the body in the present moment. So the accumulation dances, all these structures that surround and are partly readable, partly predictable, it's about this stretching of time. So it's about anticipation and memory and the transformation of movement in that relationship. So to my mind, and this is why I thought that it was put by the speaker really well, is that it's about the prediction. It's about this line as a score of what I'm going to do, but also as a trace of what I've done. And it complicates the way you watch her activity, because it is anticipation and memory elaborated in the relationship between the line and the body, which is why it's the act of drawing rather than the product, a process that leads to this product, to my mind. So.
I have a question for Benjamin Buchla. I'm slightly puzzled about the use of the term recuperation, whether it's somehow a pejorative synonym of historization or whether it's something else. But my question is, if we're talking about historization, but it seemed to me that part of the problems that your paper express have to do with representing some of these works or reenacting them. Would you go even further to say that what is missing from, in a sense, what you felt was missing in the show, the dialectical flip side, the negative side, so the element of control and failure of this promise, would you say that it's missing in the representation of this history today because there is some sort of repression at stake, maybe to do with the legacy of the 60s? Do you think there is some sort of, maybe not, I don't know if traumatic is too loaded a term, but an element of repression in representing the 60s and this history of performance in sort of a bubble?
Yeah, I think if I understand you correctly, it sounds like a very good question. I would probably have to say we don't know whether this show was really aiming to be a historical exhibition, whether that was its primary motivation. It starts like a very historical project, but then it veers off into some very specific chapters, Right? So nobody would fault the exhibition for not having fulfilled its duty as a historical exhibition if it never claimed to be a historical exhibition. Right? But there are certain dimensions of the history of drawing that are so manifestly absent from the exhibition, and I'm not going to start listing them,
absolutely.
That clearly what I was trying to say should be remembered when one constructs a heroic account of drawing transforming itself into this fantastic access to social space with means of performative operations, as though there was an unfettered availability of that history that we could presently resuscitate. That was my criticism. And I would therefore, if I understand your question correctly, say I would very much like to have the counter-narrative being present in the sense where drawing is reflecting on precisely the disappearance of access to agency, because it has been one of the most important elements of drawing in the 20th century that I can see as well, or where drawing has dismantled itself from performing agency for others. That's why I should have ended with Stanley Brown in the fantastic Stanley Brown diagrams where he says, I can't draw, I'm not drawing, you can make a drawing, you can tell me where to go. But that, of course, in and of itself is a tragic recognition of the absolute disappearance of agency from drawing as well, and a tragic acknowledgement of the travesty of participatory models, right? I mean, that's what's so great about Stanley Brown is that he really ultimately does not celebrate the participation, because if you reduce the participatory act to being told where to go from the train station to a station in another street in Amsterdam, if that's what the dialogue between agency and participation has become, then you have to think about that, right? And I think in that sense, the counter-narrative is present in the exhibition, but very sparsely so, whereas the counter-narrative that is inherent in people like Johns or Warhol is a bit absent for my taste, right? And yes, in a certain way it does, I think, because it precisely mobilizes the horizon of participatory practices at the moment when they're completely inaccessible, or they are accessible as total spectacularization, as in the performance of Marina Abramovich, precisely, right? That's the climax of that agenda that has come into its own there, absolutely. Do I understand your question correctly? Okay.
Shall we? Do we need to finish up? Okay. I think we'll finish there then. And thank you. And if I could invite you all to join us just for a small reception outside, we can linger there for I think until 5:30 if we want to. We have some wine and so on. Please join us.